Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining me is the man, the myth, the legend himself, the editor of the Marine Corps Gazette, the editor and publisher of the Marine Corps Gazette, the publisher of Leatherneck Magazine, none other than Chris Woodbridge. Woody, what is up? Welcome back.
Mac, good to be back. How are you?
I'm good. Give us an update on the Gazette. Are you guys still going into work? Are you telecommuting like everybody else? What are you guys doing?
We're actually I would say 99% what I call distributed operations for the for magazine editorial process and production. We come into the office occasionally when we've got to deal with some snail mail or actually have to meet with another human. But everything that we're doing, in fact, last week, Wednesday was our production deadline on the May edition of the magazine, and we produced that whole magazine by telework, telecommute, and in a distributed manner. So really didn't skip a beat. Did require us to kind of look at our processes a little bit and essentially try to go as paperless, which, believe it or not, is something of cutting the cord for us older folks.
But, right.
But it's been effective, and we're going to have a great edition in May. We're just going to continue to march from there. We're in the midst of putting June together now, and I don't need to see any of my team for that. We're doing it all, leveraging our shared drives, collaborative tools, and email, and texts, and phone calls, and everything else that's really becoming a fixture of daily life now for everybody, I think, or most everybody. We're doing well. The base is definitely, our offices are on board Quantico, so the base is still open. They're operating under what is essentially a code yellow modified essential personnel only on the base, so the traffic is great. you got to see the upside. I mean, traffic around here is usually
God, it's the worst. And that comes from somebody who lives in Southern California. I mean, it's not universally bad in Southern California. Man, the 95 is the worst.
Seriously. It truly is, and even that is benefiting from from this tough situation that we're in.
So let me ask you, Woody. You're a business operator, do you think this will change permanently the landscape of business? I mean, you're now. I mean, we got told years ago paperless was a thing of the future, but it hasn't really happened. We've been told for years that telecommuting is the way of the future. Do you think this forces those issues? And for a lot of people, no matter what your age is, you're learning that, in businesses, we don't really need that big building to get what we need to get done. Do you think this will, change, the way business is done permanently?
I think it certainly can. And I think it's going to change some businesses, even in the short term. I think the real answer to that is going to depend on how long nationwide, largely, we go through this. It's certainly going to last, an indefinite period of time right now.
Right.
And there's a lot of unknowns. I'm not going to tell anybody anything they haven't heard on the 6 o'clock news anywhere, that we really don't know when these restrictions are going to be lifted, and whether they're going to be lifted in sort of waves and some things rolled back. Right. But it's certainly another month or more. And then there's possibilities of things things changing come fall and next winter. So the longer this lasts, I would say, yeah, there's going to be some very far-ranging impacts. You know, my little niche on the business side is twofold. I mean, obviously, it's the publication of the magazines, and you're right. There was about 10, 12 years ago, a lot of exuberance over, we're going to, you know, print is dead. And that hasn't been the case. I mean, print is very much alive. And the, I put it in the yes and category. So, yes, we're still going to have print paper magazines, but our readers, our customers demand that and other features. So they want digital content. They want blogs, podcasts, audiovisual podcasts. They want yes and so that's been what we've been doing. And the bulk of that, except for the print magazine, you know, resides out there in the digital space. So I think what this is forcing us to do is really have a growth spurt, and grow into that space more than we had been in the past. I think it's really going to touch some other businesses. If you think of education as a business, right. We are, I think a lot of people are starting to realize that, the brick and mortar schoolhouse is not as essential as it might have been, at least not for education. the other things that go on at that brick and mortar schoolhouse, the social interaction, those things are certainly vital to the development and maturation of children and young adults. And then in some places like my hometown of New York City, the schools are essentially a distribution center for free meals for low income families, and so it's there's other things that physical node does, but right. Education function, I think everybody's starting to recognize that, that 6 or 7 hour school day had a lot of things built into it that aren't necessarily essential because my middle school, high school, college age family members are getting that work done in half the time by focusing on it at home and exercising one degree of discipline or another to do that home, distributed learning. And we're actually doing it on the Marine Corps side as well. All of the schools, colleges and schools of Marine Corps University are not having physical classes anymore and haven't for about a month now. So everything from the staff NCO academies to Expeditionary Warfare School, Command and Staff College, Marine Corps War College, all of them are using distributed learning right now. And believe it or not, so is, you'll appreciate this, Max, so is TBS. TBS has gone to all remote platform instruction, getting piped out over Adobe Connect and a couple of other applications. And really the only thing that TBS lieutenants are doing physically is the field work. That's kind of the only time they're together, if you will, is when they're outdoors, for nature walks and other hands-on activity on the ranges, etc. So that's now, I do a period of instruction for every class of lieutenants on the professional journal and professional development, and now we're going to be pushing that out over Adobe Connect. So it's certainly illustrated something about our education model, and I think is forcing us into a 21st century more adult learning and more independent or remote learning. And I don't know that necessarily will come back the way it was before if this extends into the next school year.
Well, I think Woody, and your business is going to be one of them. Everybody's going to get a chance, or everybody's going to be forced to do, whether it's distance learning or distance business, and they're going to find that, there's cost-saving measures in all of this that we can apply that will really take the pressure off my budget and might allow us to do other things with some of those things that we save money on. And so I think whether it's education, they're going to find that. I told my daughter, I said, let me just tell you this. You are not going to go back to school 5 days a week. That's a thing of the past. I'll tell you that right now. And some of the money that's going to be saved will be used to do other things. I said, but, you know, this is going to forever, in my opinion, change things. And then just a comment on, you said, you know, unintended consequences, you know, and things that you didn't really expect. I saw a story about a farmer, a strawberry farmer in Georgia, who is looking at plowing his entire crop because he sold to schools around the nation. And he said, there's no more school lunches anymore. So our biggest customer is gone.
Right.
And not, you know, cut their orders in half, went to zero. And so things that are connected to our ecosystem that you don't really realize. I mean, you saw, stories late last week of, you know, dairy farmers dumping 25,000 gallons of milk and whatnot. And you're just like, are you kidding me? Good Lord. And so pretty interesting times we live in. I want to talk a little bit leadership with you relative to the Navy before we talk about this month's Gazette. Give me your opinion. Can you be publicly insubordinate on an unsecured channel and survive that?
I don't think so.
No matter what the pretext
I think there are there's a right way and a wrong way to go about doing that. And by definition, insubordination is not something that can be tolerated. I mean, you can have a professional disagreement with your chain of command to a point. But at that point, your options are resign. And you can do that somewhat publicly. But your option is not opening up some leaked back channel sort of communication in order to, and it's ironic that you bring this up because the April edition of the magazine is all about operations in the information environment. All right, and so the deliberate leakage or deliberate oversharing of communications of information intended perhaps for one recipient or a small group of recipients, but that then becomes, public domain, that's frankly just bad form as a leader. I would say it is not to be tolerated, particularly among senior commanders. That said, I don't think that the entire incident was handled well at any level.
Well, I want to talk to you about some of that stuff, but I mean, if you know, I think the Secretary of Defense and in his comments and the CNO, nothing's been taken, off the table to include his reinstation. I think that is simply eyewash, as they try to appear neutral, waiting for the investigation that into what happened. How did this get so sideways? And so, to me, if he's reinstated, what you tell any commander at any level is, if you're not satisfied, you can go out, you can be insubordinate on a non-secured net in public to the media, and you can still save your job. If that happens, good God.
Sends a very bad message. And essentially makes, you can't unring that bell. That makes for a new normal now. Are we going to tolerate that with a colonel captain level command? Are we going to, tolerate that with a sergeant squad leader?
Yeah, what's the difference? I mean, so how do you do good order and discipline if you restore him? Let me ask you this. The CNO didn't make a comment throughout all of that when it was essentially the acting Secretary of the Navy's event. And to me, there's a couple things here. One, and then, if you, I'm not endorsing anything Secretary of the Navy said or did. Okay. But what I will say is this. He seemed to be indignant over the fact that he, as the Secretary of the Navy, had spoken specifically to the captain of the Roosevelt. And, you know, in their conversation, you know, he said, hey, look, my people are on it. Anything you need? No, I was concerned a few days ago, but everything's been ironed out. I'm good. And the next thing he sees is this letter. So my first question is, why were sailors from the Roosevelt allowed to go on Libo in Vietnam in March? I mean, right next door, they've been dealing with the coronavirus for going into their third month. And yet we're going on Libro in Vietnam right next door, and we don't think it's going to impact us. You know, so to me, that's the first question. The next question is, when did the what was the chain of command doing that was so abhorrent to, you know, Captain Crozier? And those guys haven't said anything. You know, you can't find hotel rooms for, you know, let's just say half the crew, 2,500 people, you know, in the space of 90 minutes on hoteltalk.coms. That's not the way it works when you're bringing an aircraft carrier trying to get it to Guam. And so, you know, but nobody said anything about that. What do you make of all that silence? And to include, after he's relieved, the CNO didn't make a statement. Is that the CNO saying, by my silence, I'm asking you to get your crystal ball out here a little bit. I will register my dissent. And should, you know, because if he's going to be relieved after we say, okay, this guy's out of line, you know, to me, if I'm the head of the strike group, I'm the one that says, I'll relieve him. It's my job. This is wrong. So what do you make of all of that? Take your pick.
Boy, I'll tell you, Mac, that's and you're kind of asking for, you know, a little bit of a crystal ball, but
a lot of a crystal ball.
The CSG admiral, you know, is on the same blue tiled passageway as the you know, the CO of the ship. I don't know what conversations they had. I don't know what other conversations in the military, in the uniformed Navy chain of command, took place. I'd like to think that people are a little more direct with each other. It doesn't mean that needs to be out in the public eye at all, that communication among, you know, up and down the chain of command. If it didn't in fact happen, I can't understand that at all. How, you know, again, we're not, you know, playing 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon here. This is the direct commander of that strike group and one of his ship captains, the the biggest, most important flagship captain. I honestly can't understand why. Well, first of all, I think they haven't been silent on the net. I think it's just not being reported because it's probably not that big a story for the media to get out there. As soon as you get up into the cabinet level of service secretaries, now we're into the you know, political blood sport of the day.
Right.
And it's an opportunity to, you know, further criticize, you know, the most senior levels of leadership out there in the public eye. I think, you know, that's man bites dog, so that leads the you know, the headline. The Navy's chain of command doing what it's supposed to do is not news. That's dog bites man and is below the waterline, so to speak. In terms of you know, selling airtime and publishing stories, so I believe that those conversations that has taken place, and it's just not making the news. So.
Got it. And that investigation is evidently is evidently wrapping up as we speak.
Yeah, very, very close to wrapping up from what I've seen in open source news, and we'll see what in fact comes of that.
I've got an email. I talked about this earlier today. There's an incredible story out today of the commanding officer of I can't remember the name of the ship, and he lied about the position of a ship because they were dead in the water for 4 hours working on one of their shafts. I don't, by any yardstick, Woody, the Navy is having terrible, terrible leadership problems, and the optics are horrible. You have any thoughts on that? I mean, this has been going on for a while, and it doesn't seem to be getting better.
I agree with you, and there are terrible optics on it. It is, I think, more concerning given the strategic importance of the Navy to this nation. I mean, the simple fact is we are a world power because starting at the end of the 19th century, we became a naval power. The Navy has – we as a nation have enjoyed the primacy of our Navy since the end of the Second World War. I mean, really, when you come right down to it, those capabilities and to a degree the invulnerability – of our fleet was uncontested for decades, and you know whether that has sort of led to some institutional complacency, whether it's a process of suffering under prior successes, a victim of prior victories and prior successes. Or whether it's suffering because of, frankly, some programmatic and financial bill paying across the Department of Defense over the last 15 to 20 years, and under resourcing that strategic service which our Navy is. I would argue that all the services are strategically important, but again we are in a world power because of our Navy and because of what the Navy does to sustain international maritime commerce. That's in somewhat of doubt right now, the leadership comes into play in that. I would not make generalizations. Senior Navy leaders are very good at what they do. There are certainly some egregious examples, and I think again because of the strategic importance of the naval service, those examples get a lot of public attention. And I don't know that was necessarily the case in prior years. Accidents happen. We've all been deployed on ships where either the ship you're on or another in your ARG or in the ESG has suffered some kind of casualty, and that doesn't become the same kind of front page news that it does today. I think a lot of that is once again the man bites dog syndrome, and is used as yet another way to criticize the senior levels of the department and the administration.
But we know what breaks squelch, and so there's two discussions. One is the one at large, and then the other discussion is the one that I think takes place among professionals that know what does break squelch and what doesn't break squelch. And to me, there's some stuff that is usual, normal, and can be blown up by a media that does not understand that. And we're all pretty, I think, savvy to that. The other one is, stuff that we know brings squelch, dead in the water and then lying about it. Like I read it, and it's, in my opinion, it's laughable. I mean, these are captains of ships, man. That's a big deal when you're the captain of a ship. And you know that's happening to me is stunning. And where did he learn that trick? Why would he do such a thing? Normally, you know, Richard Nixon didn't invent the plumber event. Okay. He applied it. He did not invent it. Those tricks had been around the city to your north, Woody, for a long, long time. And so, to me, amazing. Some of this stuff, and it's like you don't think that you have a higher duty. And so, I don't know. All right, let's switch gears. Let's talk about your. I'll get you out of the crystal ball business. But these, right? But I mean, these are. I mean, everybody's talking about them. You know, this stuff is amazing. I in the last month finished listening to The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. Have you read it?
Oh, great book! Yes.
Oh my God. And I wonder
a phenomenal story.
Oh, you know the Taffy 3 and those destroyers. Turning around, you know, Ernest Evans without orders and saying, let's go, boys. And then you read that they fired all their 5-inch guns, I think, off any we talk at a lone Japanese officer waving his sword. You got to love those guys, right? I can't remember his name, but the dude in the gunnery officer and his gun director up there, like, oh, hell no. Right? And the way we did computers back then that slewed all the guns to the gun director to me. But to me, the biggest thing that when I think of the Navy, I think of, you know, our pivot to the Pacific, right, and all that entails. I think of what was going on below the decks of the Johnston, of the Samuel B. Roberts, of the hull, as those sailors tried to keep those ships afloat while they were getting smoked by 5-inch, 8-inch, 14, 18-inch rounds, some of them that didn't even detonate because the walls were too thin to set off the fuse, and that, you know, pipes carrying steam that was 900 degrees melting human beings. I mean, that is not warfare for the faint of heart. I mean, you better be iron souls, you know, deeply committed to what you're doing. And so, to me, you know, taking on the Chinese, that is no small task. And you know, I won't ask you to comment unless you want to. But I mean, it's
no, I agree with you. And that you know, that legacy of you know, the Navy, when we talk about peer adversaries in naval warfare, again, for decades, our Navy has enjoyed you know, being the top of the food chain. With, you know, by a variety of means, technological, tactical, our capabilities were, again, sort of unassailable. And, you know, there are competitors now who have developed asymmetric advantages. That means, no, we may be in that sort of Navy fight once again. And, you know, I truly believe that that today's sailors will be equal to that sort of challenge. And it's going to be horrible because that you know, the nature of that kind of combat is not something that, you know, five generations of Navy has not dealt with. So it's going to be difficult, but I think they are, for the same reasons that, you know, our Marines are, you know, certainly different from their forefathers in World War II, but have proven eminently capable of the challenges of close combat. I think the Navy will find that too, but it's going to be a very hard lesson, and it's going to be a very ugly fight. And I think it's... it's going to shock the system.
Well, again, if anybody reads those stories, you know, to me, what the ship is doing is one thing. What's going on underneath? in the bowels of those ships as people are blocking and shoring and doing all the stuff we learn in damage control, the conditions that you're doing that in are just are ungodly. You know, and again, the other thing is you look at casualty numbers from World War II, the Army and the Army Air Corps, you know, by far led with 318,000, almost twice that number wounded. Interesting statistic numbers relative to naval warfare. The number two service relative to killed in action is the Navy,
right,
at almost three times the rate as Marines. And they have twice as many killed as they do wounded.
Right.
Every other service, it's the exact opposite. The Marine Corps has 24. The Navy has 62,500 killed and 37,000 wounded. I mean, just inverted from everybody else. Marine Corps, 24,500 killed and 68,000 wounded. So, you know, pretty much a little bit more than 2-1. And so the nature of naval combat is much more deadly.
Yes.
In terms of deaths and wounded.
It's far more lethal. And it's, you know, it's lethal on something of an industrial scale. You know, and the environment of a you know, a fighting warship is not kind to human beings.
Oh my God! No, I mean, I'll tell you what. If you've never either listened to or read Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, by all means, I mean it's riveting. It's riveting what, you know, what happens there. You know, the other thing that's kind of interesting, Woody, from a historical point of view, is how the Navy treated Halsey. You know, one of the nation's divas from World War II, right? One of the guys who comes out, but the Navy never ever names a carrier after him because of some of the controversial stuff he does. And if you read or watch even today, what were the documentaries, you know, that they did about Battle at Sea, or what were those things that we watched?
Victory at Sea. Amazing series.
If you watch the Leyte Gulf thing, they don't say anything about Halsey and going for the bait and leaving the beach exposed, blah, 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 blah. None of that.
Right.
It's pretty amazing and historically that the Navy protected him. And so, but it's one of the most riveting stories and one of the most incredible stories of World War II. It's certainly relative to naval warfare. It is the, let's talk about your, you want to talk about the April magazine?
Sure. The you know, as and there is a you know, I think there's a direct connection here because a lot of what we've been talking about, whether it be you know, the pandemic response, whether it be relief of Captain Crozier, I mean, all of that exists in the information environment, and you know, the view of that and the way we've sort of evolved as a service in our thinking and our operations in that environment is really the heart of everything that's in this this April magazine. I mean, for certainly since my time here as editor, we've used April as a focus edition, really sort of focusing on the C4 warfighting function. So command and control, both the, you know, the technical means and the kind of the art and science of command and control.
What are the other two C's in C4?
Command, control, communications, and computers.
And cyber's not part of that.
No. Well, you have computers, therefore you're touching cyberspace, but interestingly, in you know, and certainly in our time, that little term has evolved from C2 to C4 to C4I to C4ISR, and has, you know, became sort of a an aegis term or a you know, a bucket for throwing a lot of really diverse and disparate functions and activities in. It's everything from the very technical aspects of communications and the electromagnetic spectrum and frequency management and wave propagation and things like that, to the nature of the information actually being carried by those systems, the collective environment of cyberspace made up of hardware, software, human beings operating those systems, a number of other functions that use and shape information in support of operations, and that covers everything from deliberate sharing of public information, telling truthful stories to domestic and allied audiences through public affairs, to the manipulation of information in order to deceive adversaries. So what used to be called psychological operations, right, or military information support operations, military deception being a subset of that, using information to deliberately mislead an adversary decision maker, things that you wouldn't necessarily consider in this environment, to include public relations, how military music. There's an article by the director of the Commandant's Own in the April magazine talking about the operational value of military music in public information and a what is now called a communication strategy plan. So that whole bailiwick of ops in the information environment is really the focus for the April edition. And one of the things that's different about it is, the Marine Corps has a deputy commandant, a relatively new position for a deputy commandant to sit on top of all of this. So everything from the more traditional C4 communications, command and control systems aspects to cyberspace, our Marine cyber forces, and how they are trained, resourced, etc., to these softer power informational means of informing and influencing various publics. Lieutenant General Reynolds, Lori Reynolds, as the Deputy Commandant for Information, sits on top of all of that, and her staff has provided about half of the content in the April magazine. And not surprisingly, a lot of it is centered on explaining how all these pieces fit together and defining, what military information power is and how it's employed by the Marine Corps, what our goals are, and how we really use operations in this very complex and diverse environment to support the other elements, the other warfighting functions of the air ground team.
Talk to me. All right, let's talk about the issue itself. Give me a couple things that you think people will find interesting about this month's Gazette.
So I'll point to the C4 and the term of art now is OIE, Ops in the Information Environment. I think everyone should really kind of start with some of the defining terms and I don't want to say it's not a primer. It's not it's not Dick and Jane from our early reading classes, but let's start by defining these terms, defining these aspects of the environment, and build our sort of our baseline vocabulary and understanding, and then start to armed with that, start looking at some of the other more specific issues. So, Mr. Eric Shaner, who is on General Reynolds' staff, has a series of articles in this edition. What is military information power? what are ops in the information environment, information defined. These are all those baselining articles. And then Lieutenant Colonel Dennis Katolin has also put two, again, very fundamental definition, information the nature of information is one of his articles. Ironically, Lieutenant Colonel Katolin was once Second Lieutenant Katolin, who was the commo for 1st Battalion, 7th Marines when I was a battalion commander. So
nice. So you're going to take credit for this? I like that.
I couldn't possibly. I'm just happy we didn't scare him off.
Well, you know, Woody, he's contributed in the past. Yes, I've had him on the program, and yeah. I mean, he wrote some. You know, I thought his piece was, and the way he looks at training, if I'm not wrong, if it's the same piece, I mean, and I know he's a very bright, articulate guy, and a great writer,
exceptional off, despite really questionable leadership in his early form.
I wasn't even going to say that, but I'm glad you did, because man, now we can get that out there.
But no, he actually wrote a couple of articles for us a couple of years ago on ethics, and actually put together the basis for an ethics doctrinal publication for the Marine Corps. So I mean, yeah, he's an exceptional guy, and proud that he was in the unit way back when, but a good officer.
Well, there you have it. Woody taking appropriate credit. Well done.
He's also up on General Reynolds' staff right now as well. So you know, you've got those baseline, defining terms, articles, and then you can add to those the content that has a more specific subject area. So. For example, we've got maneuver warfare in the cyber domain. So applying our doctrine of maneuver warfare in this certainly new and dynamic domain of the operating environment. One you'll probably appreciate by Major Brian Kerg is more command, less control, which really talks to some of the what I'll call the art side of the art and science of command and control. The idea of actually practicing mission type orders, trust tactics, and enabling subordinate informed initiative is a backbone that sometimes all of the technical means of the control side of command and control can work against. In other words, just because you can communicate all the time over thousands of miles with small units, you don't necessarily, or you shouldn't necessarily do that constantly. We talk about further articles. Again, you can't get away from the electromagnetic spectrum side and the technical side of communications. So there's some of those in there, and there's some manpower articles as well. So how do we good article by Captain Eric Ramsey on talent management for cyber warfare. So how do we sustain, grow, and recruit and maintain that workforce of our cyber warriors when they are in demand elsewhere? Those skill sets are in demand elsewhere. We've also got some looking through the lens of command and control, a piece on expeditionary advanced base operations and what the command and control considerations there are. That's by Mr. Mark Riccio, who's actually an instructor with the College of Distance Education and Training down at Camp Lejeune, and Major William Grimble wrote that one. Again, looking at this future operating concept, or this emergent operating concept, which, oh, by the way, the Marine Corps is redesigning itself for and addressing the command and control aspects of that. So there's there's an awful lot in here. Some people I've actually been critiqued by some of the readers that there's just too much in that focus area in this edition. We overloaded it with the information subject area. And I'll tell you that what you're looking at in the print magazine is only about half the material of the material that we received on the subject. And so if you go to our website, you're going to find under the web articles a like amount of published material on the same subject.
You know, Woody, you first of all, I don't think there's such a thing as too much. You may not be able to read it in short order, but when you're beginning to research something and you start looking for information, there's no such thing as too much. You can, you know, for people that are interested in information operations, they will certainly wade through it. So let me just rebut that criticism right now.
I agree.
I have an email here, and then but I always ask you this, so I'll ask you this now. How about something that made your digital edition that didn't make the print edition that you would recommend to us this month?
I'm going to expand on that a little bit, and let me start with a shameless plug. One of the things we're looking for ways in the association where we can better support folks, Marines, our members during this kind of unprecedented pandemic response period. So one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to kind of open the paywall a little bit so that anyone can access the April edition of Leatherneck, actually starting today. So, regardless of whether you're a member or not, you can get to the April edition of Leatherneck on our website, time now. And then on Thursday, we'll be opening up the April edition of the Gazette in the same way. So for folks who are SIQ or confined to quarters or otherwise can't get out and about, here's another resource for them to continue their professional development while they're potentially isolated.
Well, let me tell you, if you have that opportunity and you don't make use of not only that but the past issues, and will it be past issues they can look at too? Will they have a chance to do that, or just these two issues?
They'll get these two issues for free, and then we are also going to be offering some what I'll call curated collections from the archives.
I like that.
That folks can get hold of. And again, making things sort of packaged a little differently. So one example that'll be coming fairly soon is, the Commandant's Force Design 2030 report, and you look at Commandant's planning guidance, you look at the National Defense Strategy, everything is pointing towards a great power competition. And so the question is, what were Marines, Friends of the Corps, thinking about and writing about the last time we were really involved in great power competition? And so I'm going to kind of call the collection the legacy, great power competition and the legacy of Cold War Marines. And these are articles that were written between about 1955 and 1965. So, past the end of Korea, but prior to the real ramp up and escalation for Marine forces in Vietnam. And there's a lot of content out there. There are far more people writing about the containment strategy, writing about nuclear deterrence, writing about the USSR and China in that 10-year period of the late 50s, early 60s, than are writing now about great power competition. And that's not an indictment, but
yes, it is. I know. Hey, I know indictments when I hear them. That's an indictment. Hey, and if it applies to you, Woody just indicted you, so take it up with him. It is true, and I'll tell you the other thing that I've got kind of interested in attempting to understand, you know, all of what the, you know, is pointed at the Marine Corps, is, you know, in interviewing Mark Kansian and interviewing guys like T.X. Hammes, you know, you're mindful of at other times when we've been commandants have been confronted with quote unquote revolutions in warfare. You know, Kennedy wanting, you know, President Kennedy wanting the Marine Corps to become the, you know, the counterinsurgency force. And, you know, and how, you know, and then, you know, later on when the Marine Corps was approached to be the, you know, the home, really the home service for the Special Operations Command. And so there's been different revolutions, different things that have come at the Marine Corps. Well, and one of the biggest one is, right, post-World War II, now we're a nuclear power, right?
Right.
And so this concept of revolutions, we're not talking about a evolution. We're talking about a revolution. So that verbiage is not new to the dialogue, okay? So, and it hasn't always been true. And one of the things, you know, Mark Kansian, you know, sensitized me to was the frequency of predictive failure in the DOD, and then around the world, the consistent predictive failure. You know, the French came out of World War I, and their solution was the Maginot Line.
Exactly.
And so the mindfulness, and so I think all that's really interesting. And the Marine Corps has been always historically such an innovative place. And then how has that been stewarded? How were those discussions done? And so I find that and all that relative to institutional behavior very interesting, Woody.
Well, you're spot on. And actually in the April edition, you got an article by Lieutenant Colonel Jamal Neville on a revolution in military affairs. And he's specifically talking about these changes in the information environment, the acceleration of communications, media, social media, and how that environment works in aid of or against you know, Marine Corps and U.S. forces operationally. So yes, we are. I think certainly looking at a revolution in the in the character of war. But I think what you see in reading some of these older articles is a much more active and robust professional dialogue about that.
Right.
And what the Marine Corps' role is. What are the Marine Corps' equities in nuclear war? You know, that sort of discussion, that sort of thinking was really alive and well back then. And you know, we'll start to kind of introduce that as a curated collection. The other thing I'll point out online for everyone to certainly look at and read is the Gazette blog. We've got a series of posts and calls to action out there right now on the Gazette blog specifically regarding Force Design 2030. The report, the substance of the report, you know, perhaps some open questions that that need to be answered in the future phases of this 10-year evolution that the commandant has set the course on for us, and then also risks and risk mitigation. What are the potential dangers or challenges that we're, you know, now putting on ourselves by redesigning or evolving a force in a very specific, operational space. How do we mitigate the risks of relevance for a Marine Corps that may be called upon to do other legacy things while we are in the midst of this this evolution?
Okay, and you'll find that in
blog. It's in our blog. Go to our Gazette homepage and click on the Gazette blog, and you can read the calls to action in the comments. At this stage, right now, to post comments. participate in that, you do have to be a member of the association. Depending on how long our current circumstances last, we may look at changing that a little bit. And there are always workarounds as well. You can find another Marine, find your fighting hole buddy who is a member, and get your info in that way as well.
All right, I've got an email for you, Mac. How does Woody see the Gazette contributing to this fundamental transformation of the Marine Corps as I see it? So Woody, you're a person who's going to have much to say about the way that this debate goes on in the Marine Corps. One of the things, again, it's interesting talking to Mark Kansian, and his talking about predictive failure, and he wrote a piece, an issue called "Not So Fast, Marine Corps," and so to me, some of the problems I have with what the Commandant's proposed is that there's pieces that we don't control that aren't in place yet. Yet the Marine Corps is already making, movements and isn't using its reserve as a hedge. How, when the Navy doesn't have a ship building plan with these ships that are going to be used that are both either designed or funded, yet we're all into that course of action and this design. And so you sit at the pinnacle of power relative to the debate. Honestly, relative to, you are at the pinnacle of power. You are the Vladimir Putin of the Gazette and Leatherneck. How do you see, because this ought to be a vibrant knockdown, drag out every bit as much as the maneuver warfare discussion, and in my opinion, even more so because of the hardware changes and the force level changes, General Berger's proposal fundamentally transforms the Marine Corps. So how do you, Vladimir, see yourself, and how do you see the Gazette contributing to this?
Well, I think you actually said it fairly well. As the Corps' professional journal, this type of debate, professional debate, dialogue, discourse, whatever you want to call it, that discussion is what the Gazette was created for over 100 years ago, to share ideas on issues of the most importance to the Corps, today. And you're right. What is being envisioned and what action is being taken with regard to force design 2030, I really don't think there are probably a couple of other subjects that are more important to the Corps today, right now, as we sit here. But this one may just eclipse them all. I'm not going to pretend that we're the only outlet for this type of discussion. You talk about Colonel Mark Kansian's article. He did not publish that in the Gazette, but I can. I can use our online presence to link to that article. I have a teaming arrangement with the CEO, the editor of War on the Rocks. We cross post and share some content from his platform that way. When again, War on the Rocks, the Commandant did a podcast with War on the Rocks. That's great. In what I envision the Gazette being, both in print and online, it's the platform for this sort of discussion, but it's also the free market of ideas. And so I will reach out and pull in content from those other platforms. All above board and perfectly legitimate to do, giving credit where it's due, sharing the sources. I mean, not pretending that it's all my content, but leveraging everything that's out there so that the Gazette becomes something of a nexus.
Got it. So likening it to you know, the Drudge Report or any kind of news aggregator. And so where would we find that?
You can find all of it on our on the Gazette's homepage.
Got it.
www.mca-marines.org/gazette. Or you can come in through the association's main landing page. In fact, if you go there now, just if you do an organic search, Google Marine Corps Association, you come into our landing page, you'll see a link right on the banner up front on that to the Gazette blog for those calls to action on Force Design 2030. And then, you know, maybe just as importantly, you'll also see a link over to the newly published MCDP 7. MCDP 7 is titled Learning. And this is the doctrinal publication companion to MCDP 1 Warfighting that talks to our service's philosophy of training and education. Learning is really the umbrella term that covers all of our intellectual development activities. That's the training side, individual, collective training, and then the on-the-job training, our educational activities, OPME, EPME, distance learning, and also self-education, what goes on when you're not physically in school or attending school or doing a non-resident course. What else do you do to develop yourself as an individual, and what does the Corps do to sustain that as a learning organization? So, you know, right from our homepage, you can plug right into those documents and those discussions that are going on.
All right, I'm taking up most of our time. I want to ask you one final question, relative to pivot to the Pacific, and especially when you look at, you know, the way the Marine Corps attempting to align and restructure itself. To me, the first steps have to be the national power steps, and that is the engagement of the Department of State and our economic power with nations in the region. And I want to ask you to comment on this. I believe the United States is going to have a window, and a lot of it because of the post in the post COVID-19 world, because of China's lack of transparency, the economic damage and the human damage that the Chinese government will have done through their lack of transparency, because they play by their own set of rules, will provide the United States and the nations of the free world an opportunity to, in my opinion, you know, an opportunity to extol the virtue of a rules-based order that we've lived in since the Second World War. And not only, you know, a confrontation at the World Trade Organization, but, you know, the free nations of the world looking at the nine-dash line and telling China, you've got to play by the rules, okay, like all the rest of us play by. And so to me, what that window of opportunity means is, you know, some sort of American and European Union, along with Canada and Mexico, outreach in the mode of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that opens economic, you know, opportunity on a scale that China can't challenge with the Western world and the free nations of the world to the nations in of the South China Sea and the Pacific region, who we need, absolutely need, for this fight, and hopefully it's a preemptive fight for something that never happens in the Western Pacific. And so to me, if you attempt to conduct that fight in a non-permissive environment where you don't have strong economic relationships, where you don't do joint exercises with the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Indonesia, and I'm talking about in the future here, the attempting to do it in a non-permissive environment, I don't know how that even happens. You know?
Yeah, you're spot on, and you're also right that is a diplomatic in terms of, you know, instruments of national power and influence. That is a diplomatic lead that the military, particularly the naval services, play a supporting role in.
Right.
When we started the discussion today, we you know, we agreed it may have been questionable to conduct that port visit in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. However, these go hand in hand. A large ship, particularly a nuclear aircraft carrier, conducting a port visit in Vietnam is very much a part of that diplomatic and informational influence that we need in the region. So, yeah, the timing probably not that great, but it's far more important than the CSG or the carrier sailors going out on liberty in Ho Chi Minh City. It's a lot more about the presence and the influence and the diplomatic and economic engagement of having that ship doing a port visit in Vietnam. But that's only one of these nations. You're right. Malaysia, Indonesia, and especially the Philippines, right. Which is, that is a fraught relationship for us historically, and certainly not made any less fraught by the current regime in the Philippines. So that is the long pole in the tent towards all of this. If we're going to be the inside force, that sort of engagement and that sort of multinational or bilateral coalition is essential to success, I think.
Got it. Okay, what haven't I asked you that this interview would be incomplete without you mentioning it?
We're going to continue to, go through something of a growth spurt with some of the things that we're offering out there online in our digital space for publication. We're going to be putting more of our articles out as audio podcasts. So think book on tape, magazine on tape. We're going to be offering some other and different non-members only free content for folks going forward. The next edition coming up in May, I think will be a hit. It's covering the entire air ground logistics team in terms of our we don't have one unified exclusive focus area for May. It's really going to cover all the elements of the air ground team and everything from strategic down to very tactical TTP level content, a lot of which for May was written by staff NCOs. So we've got and NCOs. So some really quality enlisted authors work in the May edition coming up.
Here's a question from somebody who heard me speak. Mac, I would like to hear your guest's response to your soliloquy on denying that Marines are crayon eaters. I was speaking to a group of Air Force people doing my post-traumatic winning thing. And I said, and just for the record, we don't eat crayons, okay? And if we find out who's spreading that shit, there's going to be trouble. So that was my soliloquy. It wasn't very eloquent. It was directed to the point. Would you care to comment on that, Woody?
I've actually never known a Marine to eat a crayon. I think that's, we're proud of, maybe that sort of popular view, but we're proud of it because we know it's not true. We know that we are, some of the most straightforward, no nonsense, toughest fighters, common sense leaders out there, and we have a sort of an anti-intellectual rind on us that is popularized in fiction and movies and popular culture, but we're proud of that, and we're rightfully proud of being the toughest kids on the block. But what we all also know is how alive and well the intellectual health of the Marine Corps really is. We're often accused of being intellectuals housed in the bodies of mixed martial artists and heavyweight boxers and that's a lot of truth in that. But at the core of our core is this this intellectual component that really can't be forgotten about, has to be sustained. That's you know why I do what I do with the Gazette, and it's unique amongst the services. I think they'd like to have that sort of family secret in the house, and that's probably why they're maybe a little jealous of us.
Yeah, so take that, what he said. The we don't eat them. We chew on them a little bit, but we don't. Most of the time we throw them at other people, okay? So if you ask Marines, what is your primary use of a crayon? They would say, well, to throw at somebody else in class when I was a kid, of course. I mean, come on. Like, what are you, stupid? All right. All right, Woody. First of all, I appreciate your time as always. And I want to say thank you to you. I think you're the one that brought it up to me, but I had a chance to take a look at some of the incredible writing in the publication about Iwo Jima. That massive publication that the Historical Division put out, and I think you brought it to my attention, but yeah. Holy smokes. I mean, and Mary Reinwald wrote a piece about in there, and what did she write about? Oh, man. I sent her a note. It's absolutely fantastic. Mary, obviously, on the Hewley board, you know, this painstaking detail. I know what she wrote. She wrote a couple pages in her piece about the are we calling it the re-identification? What's the appropriate term?
I think it's re-identification is the...
Right,
is the,
right. At one point she talks about John Bradley,
mm-hmm.
About Pi Keller and Harold Schultz. All of them do the same thing. They come home and they never talk about it.
Right.
Why? And I think you know, her explanation is as good as I've seen. Bradley knows he doesn't know initially that that's not him. But I can only imagine when you look at his pictures, as he's looking up as he's going around on the Seventh War Bond tour and they're raising more money than anybody thought could ever be raised. He's looking at that thing and going, that isn't me. And at some point, one of these rubes is going to figure it out. I'm not wearing my leggings, my legs,
right.
my trousers aren't cuffed like I wore mine. You know, I didn't have, you know, wire cutters or whatever is hanging down on that thigh. You know, a grenade, you know, whether it's a wire cutters or a grenade, you know, launcher device. I mean, they're not all stupid. I mean, they're not all crayon eaters, for God's sakes. I mean, and you can, so, but why doesn't Bradley say anything? You know, he got voluntold to be on that thing. Hey, Doc, you were part of one of the flag raisings. And you can imagine all the permutations that took. We need you on this war bond tour. Let's go. Okay, and then it turns into something, and now I'm going to stand up in front of the whole country when I got pushed into this thing. And I thought her explanation was absolutely wonderful, so I want to thank you. And then guys like Pi Keller, why would you never stand up and say, you know, I was in that picture?
Right.
And it was just they were men from a different time.
That's the key.
And they did not want all the attention that they saw being – you know, foisted upon those, you know, two Marines and a sailor, you know, and just what it turned them into. And they wanted no part of it. And so, but I thought, I just want to thank you because, and Kyle Gentry writes in it, and I know Kyle, but it is PhD level stuff that they write. And if you're a military historian and you're at all interested, you can get it for free if you write them. So you just got to go and check it out. But thank you very much for pointing me in that direction.
No, it's a great product and you know an amazing story, you know, now in its you know in extra innings, getting this you know, corrected and the whole re-identification effort. None of that does anything to minimize the sacrifice and the fight during that battle. And this is just a great story and amazing men who were, as you say, truly of a different time, different mindset back then.
Right, right. No. All right, Woody, thank you very much for doing this. Happy Easter, and good luck to you and everybody at the Gazette and the Leatherneck as you guys, you know, write a little bit of new history in the organization's annals. And thank you very much for coming on and doing this.
Thanks, Mac. Appreciate it. Everybody stay safe. Wash your hands. Stay home. Everybody knows the right thing to do. Now you just have to do it.
Well, you know, I've said here on the program, if you've lived on a ship, you've done this before, Groundhog Day. Now there's a few more stipulations this time around, but if you can recall what it is to live on ship and to go through this, you get in a routine and you tell yourself, I'm going to be better at the end of this. I'm going to PT. You know, instead of once a day, I'm going to PT twice a day, and I'm going to get a list of 10 books and I'm going to read them. Or listen to them. And when you turn around and look back, you're going to say, geez, I actually lost those 20 pounds. And then you got to try to keep it off. And I actually did read, you know, those 10 books. And I am a better person for it. So, you know, we've done this before, and we can certainly do this again. I think we have things to teach people about those kind of things. Hey, use this extra time now that you don't drive to work. Right, you got 2 extra hours, or you know, somewhere between 1 hour and 2 extra hours a day. What are you going to do with it? Use it productively. Don't lay on the couch and watch TV. And so, anyway, I think we have much to teach in this area.
Yep, I agree.
All right, bud. Take care.
All right, you too.
There,
talk to you soon.
You bet. There you have it, Chris Woodbridge here on a Monday. That'll do it. If you're just tuning in the first hour, where you talk a little bit about China. And I alluded to it with Woody, but the opportunity that the United States has in a post-COVID-19 world to reinforce the necessity that the rules-based order that has been such a huge part of the development of the world since World War II, so a relatively short period of time, be maintained. And that China needs to become a part of it. The rest of the world doesn't need to join China in its world according to GARP scenario. And so the United States and the nations around the world are going to have a chance to vote on it. And, you know, this is kind of stuff that the UN, which has been largely silent throughout, is supposed to play a role in. And in my opinion, the UN is the most ineffective organization on the planet. Clown show. So anyway, so you'll hear some of that. You'll hear also the first time I've ever heard a Japanese soldier, it's actually an ensign, who survived the Battle of Iwo Jima say that the sacrifice of the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki saved the Japanese nation. Because had the United States conventionally invaded Japan, there would still have been no surrender, and the 100 million people would have suffered mildly. And then if you look at planner estimates, American estimates were that possibly 10 million people would die. Japanese would die. How about that? Yeah. So anyway, talk a little bit about that. So happy Easter. Set some physical fitness goals. Right, this thing's getting better. We're all learning, adjusting to it, and it's all, as the days go by, it's only going to get better and better. And there's going to be days when there's setbacks. Today, the subject is, you know, why did people that tested negative for it now test positive? Well, I would say, look at the test. Are you sure the test wasn't a false negative? And so, qualitative testing—that's part of that story. But this is going to get better, and just make sure you're a better version of you when it does. So with that said, have a great one. Grant Newsham going to join us tomorrow and talk about China. On a Monday, All Marine Radio, over and out.